Welcome to the Pilates Progressions Program. I'm Katrina Foe, your host for tonight, and I just want to welcome everyone, and I just want to encourage you that if you have a question, to give me a call, and we can talk directly live on the show. The number to call into is 347-838-9945. Again, that's 347-838-9945. Tonight, we have a couple questions, really great ones. Some of them are follow-up to other things we've talked about before. And then I wanted to start out, though, with some announcements and a discussion about this time of year. We typically have a lot of cold and flu and sickness in general and how to deal with that as a Pilates instructor. So I've got a couple different aspects to talk to you about with that. All right, so first off, announcement. February 20th, that's not this weekend, but next weekend, Reformer 1 is at Personalized Pilates in Scottsdale, Arizona. So there's still time if you want to start teacher training, or if you have a friend, relative, et cetera, you can get on that. Or if you want to audit them, just give us a call, email, and stuff, and let us know. So, okay, we want to talk about cold and flu season. You know, you'd think that cold and flu season is going to be more like around Christmas time, but actually at Christmas time in December in general, we tend to get more cancellations for traveling. And it isn't until like January, February-ish that people really start slamming us, both instructors and clients, with all the sickness. So I want to take a few minutes and discuss different situations in terms of how to handle this business-wise, because it's sticky. There's nothing good about having to deal with cancellation policy, and I think it's probably most instructors' least favorite issue. So the typical cancellation policy goes something like this. If the client cancels less than 24 hours, they'll be charged full price. Okay, now a lot of studios leave it at that, and I want to just discuss some issues with that. We have some information, I think it's one of our bonus videos, on the cancellation policy, but just to remind you if you haven't gotten to it, I don't think that's very fair, just frankly, because what happens is if the client cancels, you know, the instructor gets screwed, and so therefore they still charge them to kind of discourage clients from canceling, as well as, you know, encourage them to call and cancel early if they think they're sick, and just because their time is valuable. Once a client calls and cancels, whether it's an hour before or 12 hours before, you're not going to get that spot filled very, very rarely, unless you've got a front desk staff that is all over it. You're really probably not going to get that spot filled, so it's a wasted spot. And a lot of people, especially if they're a waitlist-only instructor, that's frustrating because they could have had that filled if that person didn't cancel. And then, of course, there's the people that do it all the time. And how do you handle that? So those people, you know, are kind of a separate topic. It's usually an issue ongoing that you need to take the bull by the horns and stuff. In order to make it a little more fair, we have actually made our cancellation policy go both ways. So at Personalized Pilates, not only does the client lose a session if they cancel less than 24 hours, but the instructor has to give the client a free session if they cancel less than 24 hours. So that means that if you wake up sick and you call and tell your client, oh, I can't come, you are not only not charging them for that day, that should be a given, right, but you are not going to charge them for their next lesson. Okay, so you're kind of losing double whammy there. And we think that's important because that way it goes both ways, it's fair. Both people, if they can't call and cancel, they are violating that agreement, that trust. You know, you want people to take it seriously and everything, and you want to respect each other's time, both of them. Okay, so we have high-powered lawyers and stuff that their time books out at hundreds of dollars. We don't want them to get frustrated because we've canceled on them, okay? And it should go both ways. So price of the session is what it is, and that's what happens. So at our studio, our instructors are expected to not only not get paid for that day, but they're not going to get paid for the next lesson that the client doesn't pay for, if that makes sense. So this can play out in lots of different ways, and there's a lot of different implications and weird, sticky things that start to happen when this goes on. So I just want to talk through some of those. And this is a scenario that actually happened at our studio, you know, last week or so. And I just want to talk through it and give you the rundown and how we handled it so you can kind of get an insight into some customer service issues and what is the best way to handle it? Because, you know, your one session, if you lose it, it's not a huge deal, but the attitude that you display with the client and how you handle it goes a long way. And you can lose clients real easy when you're not fair and just in your cancellation policy enforcement and the kindness that goes with that. Okay, so first off, let's see. So the instructor had a client at 8 in the morning and then 10 in the morning, and they were just working that morning. And they came and taught the 8 o'clock, and then they just were like, I can't do the 10 o'clock. I'm dying. I need to go home. So we called the 10 o'clock person and let them know. They didn't come to the studio not knowing and stuff. And the instructor went home and went to bed. Well, now, that's all fine and good. However, what the problem was and is then is, what about the next day? Well, she didn't have any clients. She wasn't working until the afternoon the next day, and she had a client at 3. She had a couple other evening clients, but I think she had 3, 5, and 6 or something. Well, you know, if you don't cancel by 3 o'clock that afternoon on the Monday, you are owing for the Tuesday. So what should have happened was our front desk staff, who we had somebody that was new and wasn't super up on all the details, and they missed this opportunity, should have asked her before she left the studio, are you going to be here for your lessons tomorrow? You know, are you going to be here? And here's the thing. If you don't have a front desk staff, that's totally fine. You have to ask yourself this, though. And you have to make that decision before you go crawl up in a hole in bed and, you know, whatever you do to get through the sickness. Because it's really important that you are kind and respectful to your clients. So whether there's a front desk staff or not, you need to handle this that day as soon as possible. And, okay, so here's what happened. She didn't get asked. So when we found out, when Larry, I should say, found out, it was about noon. And so he texted her. Well, she had gone home and gone to bed and did not wake up till about 6 o'clock that night. And she texted, emailed, whatever, back. And, you know, of course, by then it's too late for all three of those clients on Tuesday. And Larry had decided, this is the hard part, as the studio owner, to make the executive decision to let it ride and see how she would be doing. That's a little risky, you know. The safe thing would be to go ahead and call the clients and cancel on them, because that way you're not out all those lessons, or to see if another instructor could cover it and if the clients are okay with that and all that stuff. However, with this particular instructor, he felt that she'd probably feel better and whatever, but he didn't know. So at 6 o'clock, she talks to him and said, I think I feel better. The only problem is I don't look or sound better. Okay, he's like, okay, well, let's talk in the morning. So she calls him in the morning. Sure enough, she's got the raspy voice, you know, and puffy nose and all that stuff. She said she felt great, but she still didn't look great. So here's what he did, and this is just a little extra going above and beyond to give you ideas, because what could happen there is that she comes in to teach, she feels fine, but hey, some people are a little gun-shy about germs, and they don't want anyone around them that has any germs. You know, it could be just a paranoia, germaphobe thing. It could be that they have a weakened immune system, and, you know, maybe they're on, you know, chemo or something. You know, it could be a really big problem if they get sick, kind of thing. Larry went ahead and called those three clients, the 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock, and 6 o'clock, and just put it on their plate and said, hey, listen, Marina is feeling fine. She's feeling great. She's clear-headed. However, she has been sick. She's getting over something, and she doesn't look great. She doesn't sound great. She is fine teaching you, and she can, you know, stay back and, you know, not cough on you and not touch you and, you know, maybe less hands-on cues today and stuff. But we wanted to give you a heads up that A, she doesn't look good, and B, if you want to go ahead and cancel, you can do that or reschedule for a different time this week. Now, he tread very lightly on that because he was not going to give those people a free lesson because he was not canceling on them. Okay, you hear that? However, he did want to give them a heads up so that they didn't get all frustrated, because that's what happens when people come in and they're like, ah, my instructor's sick, I'm scared of getting sick, and they'll make a big fuss, and that can be a big problem. So what happened? All those people ended up coming in just fine. One person rescheduled to later that week and was very happy that Larry let him know ahead of time. Okay, so It's a great thing to think of through all the different scenarios, because what you don't want to have happen is when you're at the studio or calling someone and you're in the scenario, to be thinking through and not see it coming. You want to be prepared and have an answer of what your policy is. So we have a very strict cancellation policy that I don't care who you are, my mom included, you are going to get charged if it's less than 24 hours notice. And same thing with our instructors, okay? We want to be fair about that. A lot of times clients call and say, hey, I'm sick. It's 3 hours beforehand. Do you want me to come? Oh, my goodness. Well, it's up to you. You're the one who's sick. It's your body. If you want to come and you get your lesson, that's fine. If you don't come, you're still being charged, okay? So what they're really asking is, I don't want to come. Can you not charge me? That's the real question. And yes, you are going to charge them. You can't not charge them, because if you do that, you're going to lose so much money. I've told you before how Larry loves to play with numbers. He figured out the numbers. If we gave a free lesson, you know, get out of jail free card on the cancellation policy just once a year to every client, it was like thousands of dollars that we were in the hole, that we lost, just flowing out like a sieve, you know, it's bad. And so I just want to encourage you, it may feel mean, it may feel hard to let them, you know, wiggle in that area. But again, if you emphasize that you have your cancellation policy going both ways for good reason, a lot of times people are a little more forgiving, understanding and such. There are those that aren't, and usually those are people that have never worked in the service industry, and they don't understand time is money, literally. So you do what you can. The scenario that always kills me and drives me nuts, and I think I can say this from a good place because I am a mother of five, is the person that's like, oh, my kid's sick today. I can't come. I'm sorry. That's not my problem. I still held your spot, you know. And usually the ones that have this happen, it happens all the time, like every other week. And so you just kind of have to explain to them, listen, I have to hold that spot. I can't get someone else in there, and you have to hold firm. It's not fair to you. They usually, what I have found is usually if you hold fast, they'll find somebody else to watch that kid for an hour. Make sure they do not think it's appropriate to bring the kid into the studio. Sick kids should not be sitting in the corner of the studio, okay? I've had instructors try to do this. No. Sick kids belong at home in bed with somebody taking care of them. And if they need to call and cancel, that's fine, but you can't be eating that. Sounds heartless, but, you know, hey, I'm a mom. I understand. It happens, and most of the time, it's a matter of their kid just needs that attention. They need to stay home with their kid. So, but they need to know that your time is valuable. Okay, so just a few notes there on cancellation policy. On a side note, when you're sick, you need to take really good care of yourself and preventatively make sure that you nip it in the bud as soon as you feel the least little bit of anything. And I would encourage you that if you think you're not going to feel good, cancel. Okay? There's nothing more annoying to a studio that has a front desk staff than people canceling an hour before. There's nothing more annoying to clients than an instructor, if you work for yourself, calling and canceling an hour before. Let them know. You know you feel like crap the night before. Let them know. Tell them, okay? And just be respectful. It's their time as well. So those are my thoughts on that. You may disagree. You may be in a different scenario, and that's okay. Everybody's scenario is different, but I just encourage you to think through all the different implications, because trust me, lots of weird things come up. And on that note, this is one of them. We've never had this scenario, because Personalized Flies is in Arizona and we don't get snow, but I've had people ask me, and so I actually, because I grew up in Phoenix, haven't really dealt with the whole snow issue, talked to Larry, because Larry grew up about an hour south of Buffalo, and they get dumped on, and I mean dumped on. I mean, he talks about times where the whole house got snowed in and you couldn't open the front door. Kind of makes me a little claustrophobic thinking about that, but anyway, so he was mentioning that if he had the studio there, that probably some ideas he would do for the cancellation policy, you kind of have to have something standing as to how they can find out ahead of time whether the studio is going to be open or not. And his idea was that They usually, on the radio at about 7 a.m., they will announce the different school districts that are closed. So I guess people listen to the radio. Maybe they don't do that anymore. probably on the internet and stuff, too, to see whether the school is closed. So whatever school district your studio is in, you could just say, okay, you know, if this school district is closed, we're closed, period, end of story. Another idea, and that way people can find out without having to call you, and you have to call like 500 people, especially if you're a bigger studio, and let everybody know and let instructors know and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, inevitably there's people that live farther away or closer in, and, you know, so everybody's got different scenarios. And to check in with everybody in the morning, oh, my goodness, that'd be awful. It'd be chaos, and you know you're going to get mess-ups and things. So having something where everybody can look at or find out is important. I thought that, you know, if you could just write it somehow up on your website, have a special little box or something that's like snow update, you know, studio is open, and just change it, studio is closed, and, you know, put the date or whatever, would be a good idea as well. So you got to have something, some kind of policy, and then I guess everybody just would eat it. So the instructor doesn't get paid, the client doesn't get a lesson, they don't have to pay, would be the best bet in order to be fair. That kind of sucks. I'm kind of glad that Arizona doesn't have snow for that reason, because that would be really harsh. And I'm sure some of you are nodding your head and like, yeah, it is harsh. I deal with it all the time. So I'm sure you know what I'm talking about. Okay, so like I said before, preventative care for you as an instructor is super, super important. You don't want to get sick. And you're going to be around people, especially ones with kids and colds and coughs and stuff, and they're going to be coming through. So you want to take care of yourself. I'm a big fan of essential oils. They do a really great job of disinfecting, antibacterial, antiviral, antifungal, all that kind of stuff without having the harsh chemicals that can damage your body and damage the good bacteria as well. So for myself, I have hand lotions. They're hard lotions that I use that have essential oils in them. If you're interested, some of you have gotten my hand lotions as Christmas presents and stuff. Those are very easy to make. I shouldn't say that. It's incredibly hard. But they're fantastic, and I put a lot of essential oils, really good quality ones, in them so that they do actually have that sanitizing effect. And you can do those. My recipe is equal parts shea butter, beeswax, and coconut oil, and then whatever essential oils to flavor it, so to speak, to give the scent. But again, citruses and lavender and different things like that tend to have a lot more of the antibacterial properties to really help with that. So instead of grabbing for those toxic chemical hand sanitizers, bleh, we have those at the studio because people are a little addicted to them and kind of weird about it, but I think they're awful. I mean, it's alcohol. I mean, terrible stuff. Why would you rub alcohol over your body? And you can make your own. There's some great recipes with like aloe vera gel and witch hazel and different essential oils that are highly effective and such that you can find on the web. And if you want, I can, you know, email those to you. Maybe I'll mention them next week. I don't have it right in front of me. But there's great ways to sanitize yourself, like these hard lotion bars, without having to strip your skin and, you know, put alcohol into your body. Because remember, your skin is your largest organ, and anything that goes in it is just like eating it. Do you want to just down a whole bunch of that nasty rubbing alcohol hand sanitizer stuff? I sure don't. There's no way you could get me to swallow that. So I don't put it on my skin either. And that is mother of five children. Okay, so the best way to prevent getting sick is actually to strengthen your immune system. Okay, so being on guard from the germs is not the best way. It's really more about making sure you have a good immune system in the first place. And you've heard me talk about things like bone broth and such, keeping your gut healthy. That's going to go a long way to making sure you get your nutrients and keeping your whole body healthy, including your immune system. But some additional energizers to your immune system, I've got two of them. I think I've mentioned my elderberry syrup before. If you go to like Whole Foods and buy elderberry syrup, it is offensively expensive. Okay, you're paying ridiculous amounts for this elderberry syrup. It is so cheap to make. So I like making things myself, if you can't tell. And this one's so easy, you'll laugh. So you take a pot of water and like just, you know, a stock pot or something. I like to make it in big batches. And you put it on the stove and you put some dried elderberries. You can get these at mountainroseherbs.com. And if you live up north, you could probably gather them and dry them yourself. But you just brew it up like tea. You can add some fun things like ginger, cloves, echinacea, anything like that that are really good for the immune system. And those also kind of give it a nice depth of flavor. So basically you're brewing elderberry, dried elderberry tea. Okay, so after you've boiled it, you know, let it steep for a while, and then you'll strain off the elderberries and whatever else you put in it and pour it into like a glass jar, like a mason jar or something. And what I do before I pour it in is I put in a whole bunch of raw honey. And raw honey has a lot of very therapeutic medicinal properties that are good for the immune system. It's great if you have a cough too, but in terms of an expectorant, but it's also got a lot of immune system builders. So I put that into the jar ahead of time, so several spoonfuls. I mean, a lot. You're making a syrup here, and then you pour, you strain the tea that you made into the jar, and you do it while it's still pretty hot, and the honey just melts. So fabulous. So you just, you can throw away the elderberries, or if you've got chickens like me, you can give them to the chickens and stuff. And I've heard people putting them in their smoothie and such. That'd be great if you've got like a good Vitamix or something. But then you're going to take that elderberry tea that you poured into the honey and just stir it up. And again, if you do it when it's hot, it's much more effective and easier to get that honey real melty and good. And then you just put it in the fridge and it'll last quite a few weeks. And you can just take a little chug every morning or whatever. And it's not something like Golden Seal where you don't want to be taking all the time. It's not going to lose its effectiveness. Making up new words here. So it's not going to be a bad thing. You could put it on your pancakes and use it as a literal syrup. We are not big into supplements. I don't believe in supplements. I believe in using whole food that's not synthetic and easy to digest for your body. But the only thing that we take is fermented cod liver oil. And it's a supplement because I wouldn't eat that necessarily. But it's a whole food still. So we will take a little bit of that, and that is amazing for the immune system, and then chase it with a little elderberry syrup because it's not super great tasting. It's not terrible. I can take it by itself, but the elderberry syrup gives it a woohoo, yum, yum taste and leaves your good flavor in your mouth. If you have questions about the cod liver oil, I'm not like a distributor of it or anything, but we get ours from Green Pastures, and we prefer the liquid cinnamon. That's been taste tested with my kids. It comes with a syringe, so you can measure exactly. You can shoot down the back of your throat, and it's very painless. My kids actually beg for it, and even Kellen takes his cod liver oil. He doesn't get the elderberry syrup because you can't give babies raw honey, but he does get the cod liver oil. Okay, so here is my other concoction for your immune system. Now, this is amazing as an actual homemade cough syrup. It is fabulous at getting the actual phlegm out, so an expectorant. It is not going to suppress the symptoms like taking a chug of Dayquil or something like that. So you're going to get very different results. So if you're used to taking over-the-counter medications for a cold, this is not going to have the same effect. This is going to speed up the recovery time, possibly prevent you from getting sick in the first place, and it's going to help boost your immune system through the whole process. So this is not going to suppress the symptoms necessarily. It's not going to make you feel all better in like 5 minutes, nothing like that. But again, that's just masking what's going on, and you're not really dealing with the truth and what's going on. I will validate that every once in a while you need to just suck it up, and if you got to go on, and you have to. Personally, I just suck it up and deal with it, but I know there are people that will still take the drugs, so I guess maybe I've been breastfeeding too long and too paranoid about what's going in the milk, but I'm very anti that stuff. So here's my super cool science experiment-like recipe. So what you do is you take, I usually do like a quart jar or something, and I put different herbs in it that are good for the immune system. So I usually put in some sage and thyme, and then cinnamon and turmeric. Now, if you know of another herb that is really great for your body, you know, you could put in some stinging nettle or something. You could put in echinacea. You could put in, you know, anything that you want that's real power-packed, you could throw it in there. Notice we've got this savory sweet thing. It's a very odd mix. My kids love it and beg for it. I don't know. So we've got this thing going on. Then what you do, I usually crush in some raw garlic, and some raw ginger. And both of those are amazingly strong in terms of antibacterial, antifungal, all that kind of stuff, and very, very good for the immune system. Then you chop up an onion, again, also very, very good for the immune system and very powerful antibacterial. You put the raw onion in on top of all the herbs, and then the whole raw onion, just, you know, take the skin off, and then you put in a whole bunch of raw honey. Okay, now I'm talking, if it's a quart jar, you got a big old onion that'll take up half to two-thirds of the jar, and then pack the rest of it out with honey. Okay, so then you just screw on a lid so flies don't get in because they're going to want to get the honey, and you leave it, and by the next day, probably, it like melts, and it's really cool and weird how the onions lose their juice and the honey, like, usually mine's pretty crystallized, and it's all gooey and like a syrup. And so I strain out the onion bits, although you totally do not need to do that. You can just chug the whole thing and chew it up a little bit if you're hardcore. My little girls don't like one in particular, does not like the chunkies. Several of them do, but one of them is very loud about not liking that. So we strain it out. And there you go. You've got a great cough syrup, sick syrup, we call it at our house, because we have everybody take it. If one person's sick or getting sick, everybody starts taking it to build up their immune system, and I swear by it, it really, really helps. So there you go, my secrets to having healthy kids that do not get sick very often. And I recommend those for you guys because you're going to be around a lot of people. Just like a kid going to school, you're going to get lots of germs being a Pilates instructor. And, yes, you can wipe down your equipment and stuff, but you're going to get it. So be careful with that and keep yourself really strong and healthy. Okay, so now on to those questions that you guys have been sending in this week. I've got a couple here. So first off, let's see. Hi, you may have already answered this question somewhere, but I have a question regarding feet and straps and which straps to use. I know we use the long straps on our feet, but I've been to a few sessions where the instructor had me use the short straps on some exercises and long straps on others. Do you know why she does this? If I'm remembering correctly, she had me use the short straps on my feet for short spine. She's trained by Peak Pilates, if that matters. Oh, and just as a postscript, do you know how hard it is to get short straps on your feet when you're as inflexible as I am? Happy face. No, I don't, but I can imagine that would be hard. Okay, so there's a couple different things here that I want to mention, and I do think I addressed this somewhere, and I'm not, I honestly couldn't tell you where, so no worries. These questions come up, and I'd like you to look at it, know the history that I'm going to give you, but then look at it as a case-by-case basis of what are you trying to accomplish, because there's different things that you can do with the different straps, and if you really understand the equipment, then it all makes sense. You know what, I think we have it in the lecture about the equipment, the springs and settings on week 11. I think that's where it is. Sorry, interrupting myself. Okay, so here's what's going on. Classically, people use different straps on different things, and usually what happens is on long spine, they put what they call strap extenders on them and put them their feet in those. So I'm not sure. I'm not sure if you maybe forgot it was long spine, not short spine, and were confused, or maybe she was confused and did it wrong. I don't know. But classically, like a Peak Pilates instructor is what they call classical, meaning they only do Joe's thing, Joe's way, you know, that kind of thing. So they would put the long strap, the extended straps, and they're actually a separate piece. It attaches to the long strap and makes it even longer. All right, so what does that do? It changes the tension and the lever length a little bit, and it puts a different amount of force, I mean, in terms of the springs, on the body. So it gives them a little more oof up, if you will. All right, so I'm really lazy, and I'm really cheap. I don't want to buy those extra extenders for every single reformer at our studio, and I'm sorry, how much of a pain in the butt is that to do in a class setting? You could go run around and do four, you know, strap extenders on there. And I think that's probably right there the reason why most teachers don't teach the long spine, because the long spine is an awesome exercise. It is profound for the hip extenders, as hamstrings, which most people are weak at. It's great articulation of the spine. People can do it if you break it down right. And all around a good exercise. But you don't see it taught that much if you've gotten around, so to speak. So I think that has to do with why. Either the studio didn't, up front get those strap extenders, or maybe they have a class and they only have one pair, or maybe they're just lazy and don't want to take the time to put them on, that kind of thing. Well, if you're lazy like me, you don't have to. And I want you to go and play with this on yourself, and you can feel the difference that I'm talking about, so you'll know what I'm talking about. So if you have ever just switched short and long straps on your hands and feet, you'll feel what I'm talking about with the lever difference and how it changes the feeling in terms of the resistance. So it makes the springs feel lighter or heavier, depending on which one you do. So if you put your feet in the short straps, it's going to make it feel heavier. If you put your hands in the long straps, it makes it feel lighter. And I'm saying if you don't change the springs, okay? So here's the other thing that I want to say is that it also has a lot to do with how you have the equipment set up. Now, Balanced Body and everything I've seen, the way you set it up is you have, when the carriage is all the way in, meaning next to the springs, the rope length should be the length so that your long strap should be taut, have a taut rope if you hook it around the shoulder rest. Okay, so I'll say that again. And that's how you want to set your equipment up. So if you bring the carriage all the way in, I usually just slap all the springs on just so it doesn't move on me while I'm doing this. I put the long straps on the straps and on the ropes, and then put them the long strap over the shoulder rest, around the shoulder rest. And then I pull the rope underneath the carriage tight so that it's firm, not to the point where it's pulling the springs. Okay, that's too much. Okay, that's going to give you the traditional long strap length. Okay, so for the feet. Okay, and that's the length you would need if you're going to add the rope extender, the strap extender on there. You would add another strap to that length. And then the short strap, we use the double loops by Balanced Body. Saves so much time because traditionally you had long loops for your feet and then you had little handles for your hands. So anything for the hands you couldn't use the other straps really for because you had actual literal handles. So you couldn't put your feet in the short straps classically because they had handles instead of short straps. Now, like I said, with Balanced Body, they have these double loops that are not what Joe had, but they're so fantastic and they make lazy people like me so happy because you can just flip from one to the other without having to do anything and you lose so much less time, so your time is more productive. You can do different things in the class that you might have shied away from just because of the loss of time and that kind of thing. All right, so then a lot of people also will change that rope length. Oh, my goodness. I've been in so many studios where they change the rope length between, like, every exercise. And I can't stand that because it's so annoying because you can never get the rope straight and you're wasting a lot of time getting the rope straight. It kills the flow. It kills, all the setup stuff. You always have to checking it. I mean, you do want to check it before you get started with the client, but it's just overkill. So if you leave it at that setting, what you can do is for things where you want a really short rope, you just hold on higher up where the straps attach in. So, for example, if you're doing pulling straps, you want a shorter rope. And so I have them hold up where the straps, the loops, attach to the ropes. We call them the rubber bits. One of our clients, our instructors, used to be English, and she'd say, the rubber bits. And she said it just so cute that we all kind of adapted that. At least I did. Then the hands go in the short loops, like when you're doing things like supine arms or hug a tree or any of that kind of stuff. The feet go in the long straps for things like feet and straps, any of that kind of thing, short spine. And then, again, you could put the strap extenders for long spine. And that's really the only one that you'd use those strap extenders. Now, here's my trick. If you don't want to shell out the extra money for the strap extenders and or waste time putting them on, especially in a group class, here's your trick. Don't. Put the feet in the long straps as usual, like you're doing short spine, but change the tension on the springs. And you can get the exact same effect feeling-wise on your body, but not have to do all the other messing around. And I just think, especially for the Balanced Body equipment, it's way easier to change the springs a little bit than to mess with the ropes. You do need to remember that other people were trained on equipment that doesn't have as much adjustability. So, for example, the peak equipment, and especially like the Grotz equipment with the classical stuff, they only had one setting of spring tension. They don't have reds and yellows and greens and blues and, you know, the A button and the B button and all this stuff to change it up. They don't have that adjustability. And if you've never worked on one of those pieces of equipment, I highly recommend it because it's very frustrating if you want to fine-tune some stuff for your client. So that wouldn't work for this. So I just put a little extra spring on. Usually like a blue will do it. And that gives them the extra support to keep their butt up higher and actually do the long spine versus the longer straps. So just keeping it in there. I think that's right. I might have said that backwards. But try that. Try putting your feet in the short straps like this person is describing and how it feels versus the long straps versus, you know, putting your hands in the long straps. And you'll notice that you bottom out on some of the arm stuff because you lose the range of motion. You'll notice that it just feels different. It's just like, that's not right. And I don't know why she put the short straps on your feet for short spine. That would be kind of going the other direction, making it shorter, which would make it way worse, so to speak. I don't know, maybe she was really trying to open you up, but that would be probably not the direction I'd go. If I had somebody that was having a hard time getting their butt up, okay, so I'll just say me when I'm postpartum, you know, after I'm my time being upside down is fine. Say a client that's just really lower body heavy or a client that's really, really weak, so that even the tension of the ropes is not helping them get their butt up. You want to help them be successful as long as they have the flexibility to get up there. So you could put a little extra spring tension on there versus having to change the spring or the straps. So you could do either one. If you, for some reason, don't want to change the springs and the person needs a little help, yes, you could put them on the short straps. The short straps would make it easier to get the butt up and over. It would help them get into the rollover. Now, if that's a flexibility issue and they can't get there, which I don't think is the case for you, you might be tight, but I've seen you do a rollover and stuff, then you could hurt them doing that. I'll just tell you a quick bunny trail story. I had a client, she was awesome. She came in 3 times a week and was very regular. She had second house and she wanted to make sure she could keep her Pilates practice up. She's very disciplined. I went over exercises to give her a little routine and helped her with that, so that in the summer she could still do it. It was a pretty remote place where there were no studios and stuff. And she did great. However, her husband started coming in, and he had some back issues. He was a golfer and everything and just wanted to work on his back. So after the, fourth or fifth time he had come in, he was doing remarkable and really getting it and stuff. He decided that he would get on the equipment that they had, they had taken a vacation, and work himself out because he loved his Pilates. Well, he did not realize that the spring settings are very important. So he put all the springs on and did his footwork and did his 100 and then proceeded to put the feet strap on. I know I'm hearing your groans, even though this is a recording. And he did short spine, and it yanked him over and totally ripped up his back, and he ended up having to have back surgery. Now, was that Pilates' fault? No, that was a person that was doing things inappropriately and not using the equipment correctly. And that's the reason why we've had people over the years ask if we'll do open gym. No. The liability and stuff is way too high because people, there's a lot to do, you know, and if you don't get the springs right, it can really mess you up. You know, if a little's good, a lot's better, right? I think is what he was thinking. Well, it's kind of comical because if you know their personalities, at, you know, dinner parties and stuff, she overheard him telling this exercise and berating Pilates and saying how bad it was, and she jumped in and said, oh, no, honey, it's not Pilates. You did it wrong. You messed it up. It's your fault. It just had me rolling with laughter because knowing them, it's just, you can totally see her doing that, and it was funny. So just a little side note, the springs do make a big difference, and they'll help you get it up if you need a little help, but not if it's going to rip you and you can't handle it. So you have a lot of power in terms of which straps you choose, and if you choose wrong, what you could do to them, and what springs you put on. And that's why, you know, if you just go by the basic stuff, but then play on your own body, you'll really get the feel of what the different straps and springs and tensions and stuff can do. And if you know what it should feel like, you can replicate that and find it for yourself. then if you take it a step further, if you understand where your weaknesses are, and then you see another client that you're like, they have my same weaknesses, they're having trouble with this exercise like I did, well, let's do that modification and, you know, lengthen the strap or whatever, like I use it on. And you can really be helpful to your client in that way. So that's one of the reasons why I highly recommend in your self-practice hours, when you're practicing on your own, to get really, really comfortable with equipment. Do things the way I tell you not to do them. Do them right, on the right settings, and then do them different. Change the foot bar, change the gear bar, spring bar, whatever you call it. Change the spring settings, change the strap length. Do all sorts of things and figure out what makes that piece of equipment tick, because it is so powerful. I mean, it looks really simplistic, but you can do so many things, and it's really powerful. So, no, you're not crazy, but you will see a lot of people out there that change up the springs and straps, and that's what I usually see. Not what you saw, but what I told you. And that's why. And I want you to have the information and the power to be able to adjust it as you need for your clients and not have to worry about any of that stuff. Okay, so hopefully that answered your question a little bit. I'm going to the other question I have here. Okay, computer loading. All right. Hi, Katrina. I was listening to the radio show 2 weeks ago with the live caller. You were talking about exercises for the psoas, so like strengthening. I was wondering if walking elephant would work the psoas, e.g. the knee coming into the chest. I feel like I've read somewhere that the psoas is the muscle that flexes the leg above 90 degrees. I read a lot, so maybe the facts are getting jumbled. Happy face. Okay, so no, you're not getting your facts jumbled. That's awesome. I love that you're reading and learning and going over your anatomy. Yes, the psoas does flex the leg above 90 degrees. You can do some before that, but that's his main thing. He also does external rotation and adduction. So there's some other things going on there. And depending on the exercise, he can do some different things with the trunk and everything because he does attach one vertebrae to the next. And there's so much complexity with the psoas. He can actually, mine's a male apparently, can help stabilize the spine a lot too. So I've heard people go so far as to argue that the psoas is a core muscle, which I don't buy that. I see the core as only doing stabilization versus the movement qualities and stuff. Although I guess the little spinal erectors also do movement, but not in the capacity of the core thing. So I see them as different, but they are very, very deep, and they are very, very important. So in terms of your question about walking elephant, I just want to review walking elephant for the rest of everybody, because that's kind of one of the obscure modifications that a lot of people forget. And I don't know that it's my favorite. It's a nice, fun little thing to add a spice and flair to, so I'm going to review it. Basically, if you take the regular elephant and then alternate one knee bending as you come in, you're going to get the walking elephant. Okay, now the tricky thing is that you have to have somebody fairly coordinated to do this with, because a lot of times it's what? And then their head's popping up and they're doing all sorts of weird shoulder things. You do obviously lose the grounding of the heel between each time the knee pops, because you're coming up, the knee that's bent comes up onto the ball of the foot. So you have to have somebody that understands that concept so that when they drive the heel back down and straighten that leg, they lift the toes back up, because that's going to get really crazy to try to cue that in addition. However, the angles that you're talking about, it's more than 90 degrees. You're, you know, flexing the hip and all that stuff. But you want to take it a step further and look at the pull angle. Okay, so the pull angle, the hard part, the part that the psoas should be working on would be on the in phase where the hip is flexing. But that is the phase that the spring is actually assisting. Okay, so the typical spring, say, on the balanced body equipment would be a red and a blue. And that's not very hard in terms of pulling the carriage in. Usually all people feel is the stretch on the back side of the body, and the walking elephant is, in my opinion, nice because it gets it in an asymmetrical way. So you can see people that do not have good abduction stabilizing in the hips, so they'll swing and sway their hips to one side. They could be very asymmetrical. You could get some nice symmetry work for people that, you know, have leg issues or imbalances or some scoliosis or different things going on. I would caution people to be throwing this out to people that are maybe not so good in their body, because a lot of times people will miss the shoulder mechanics and things that should, in my opinion, are very important on the elephant. Transformative, I would go so far as to say, if you start getting heavy on the coordination with, like, walking elephant. So that's why I don't use it too much, because most of the time when I'm teaching elephant, I am talking and doing so much with the shoulders that there's not really time and there's not really brain power. let's get real, right? There's no more brain power left to get the alternating legs and stuff. But for your question, I don't think walking elephant's a bad exercise. It's not going to work the psoas unless you change the springs. So you could drastically change the walking elephant in two different ways if you wanted to really focus on the psoas. So one would be to drastically reduce the springs on the elephant. Now, that is going to throw a lot of work up into the shoulders and up into the abs to keep that carriage from flying out. So again, if they don't have good shoulder mechanics, I wouldn't go there, because they're going to be shoulders and ears, and they're going to lose their serratus and all that kind of stuff. The other way would be to change the direction. So if you're pushing the carriage out, if you're pulling against the spring on the phase where the knee comes into the chest, then you're going to get the psoas working. And the way you could accomplish that is if you have the infinity foot bar, and you could pretend you have it by putting a box up over the risers possibly, or messing with that, but the infinity foot bar works really, really well. You can put it back behind the shoulder rests. Okay, so like we have it in, I think it's lesson 9, I'm not sure, for that second half of the reformer stuff. You can turn around so your head's towards the ropes, and then on the phase where you're doing the elephant, where you're pulling your thighs towards your chest, so that would be what's working the psoas, you're pulling the springs apart. Okay, so that's where I want you to start thinking. If you understand the mechanics and you think about where the spring and pull is and everything, you can change these exercises subtly to try to accomplish what you're looking for if you have a specific client. Now, I don't know if you just really, really want to do the walking elephant, but so I just use that as an example. Probably my favorite exercise for the psoas is going to get that hip flexion above 90 degrees, and I like to do it from the kneeling abdominals facing the ropes. Okay, sometimes this is called reverse knee stretch, and what you're going to do is you're going to put your hands on the frame of the carriage, and your knees are up against the shoulder rest. You're in a quadruped position, so hands and knees. And you're going to just keep the spine absolutely straight. If you bend the spine, it's not going to hurt you, but you're using rectus abdominis to flex the spine, and we're trying to get the psoas. So you want to keep the spine still and just flex at the hip and pull the carriage under you. So again, this would be the same thing. You're pulling the carriage out on the phase that the knee is coming towards the chest. So you're working against the springs, and that's where you're loading that psoas. And what you'll feel when you're doing that, if you keep that back really straight, is it feels like abs. Okay, thus the name kneeling abdominals. But it's not abs because the spine's not moving, and the abs move the spine. Got it? I know. I'll say that again. So you know it's psoas because you feel like it's abdominals. It's deep in, really, really deep in. And if people are really articulate and connected with their body, they'll say it feels like it's, you know, back by my spine. It's really back there. But they aren't moving their spine, so you know that it's going to be psoas flexing the hip, not abdominals flexing the spine. This is a good example of one that I think is fine to do with a pregnant client, because it's not going to mess with a diastasis or cause one, and they can they'll feel like they're doing psoas. They're not really doing ab work except for the transversus holding in, but it's nice to get that feeling sometimes, especially if they're giving you a hard time about wanting to do ab work. Throw this their way, and then you're actually working psoas, not abs, and they might shut up. You guys know the clients I'm talking about where they are like, no, I want to do this. And, okay, even though you explain it to them, they don't get it. They don't believe you, whatever. Anyway, so that's my thought, is throw them kneeling abdominals, and I would usually do that on one spring or a red and a blue for two legs. I would definitely do a red and a blue. Now, a lot of people can't handle that, so you can start in a red. You can do the same version with one leg reaching out behind you, and then I'd probably do just the red to keep those hips nice and still and the back straight. Okay, so hopefully that helps. If you want to talk more about the psoas, we can do that. So if anybody's got more thoughts or wants to talk about more about the psoas, let me know. All right, so I think that's going to go ahead and, you know what, I'm going to talk one more thing since we have a little more time. I wanted to talk about opposition. So this, nobody asked a question about this, but this, a lot of people ask about how to get their clients to go deeper, how to get the clients, how to get yourself to go deeper. And so I want to give you this little tip and trick about opposition. Now, opposition, I'm not talking about the opposing muscle group. I'm not talking about muscle balancing. I'm talking about, like, levers opposing each other. So you're in, within your body having opposing members gone. So I'm going to try to give you some examples so you can feel this. Almost, I can't think of an exercise that doesn't have this. So if you think of one, let me know or ask me what the opposing thing is, and I'll be happy to go over it. But sometimes there's even multiple points of opposition within the exercise. And the reason you want to find this within the exercise is because it is your key. This is your gold to taking it to the next level. You will get so much more out of the exercise when you feel the opposition and you find it. This is where you can, you know, just really pump the exercise for all it's worth and get more. This is also going to ensure that people do not hurt themselves. If they find this opposition, they're much less likely to have the wrong muscles turned on. So it's a great cueing technique. If you listen to the iPilates, I'm sure you will find me cueing this throughout, you know, different exercises. I don't usually talk about opposition because it kind of confuses clients, although you certainly can. I just don't have a lot of time in iPilates recordings to say all that I do if there's a real person in front of me. So there's just some thoughts there. Okay, so here's an example. Mermaid. So just the regular classical mermaid on the reformer. I would say that the opposition is between, say, the arm that's going overhead, say it's the right arm, reaching out over the foot bar, like it's reaching away from your body, and then the opposition would be reaching down into the mat with that same hip, so the right hip. And what happens? The arm doesn't want to stretch out, the hip wants to fly off, and if you get that opposition, you're really going to get the side bending, not only in the hip, but in the waist, in between the ribs, in the armpit, all that stuff, just 10 times deeper. And so you want to find that. And you, there's tons of cues you can talk about with this. A lot of them you've heard before. You can talk about keeping the hip down. You can keep about reaching out the fingers. I like to do a tactile cue where I will put my hand, like I'm saying stop, up against their fingernails of the top hand, and I'll say push into me. So I'm trying to get that energy reaching through that. And instead of me pulling on them necessarily, again, that would have a different context, accomplishing a different goal. And then press your hip down as you push into me would take it full circle. And you can say something like, feel the opposition between that hip and this hand. You know, kind of point to them or, you know, whatever to get that. Okay, here's another example. The rowing back series with rotation. So you're facing the ropes. Your legs are through the shoulder rest, sorry, a little mental lapse, and you're going to bend one elbow and turn towards that elbow as if you're going to turn around and face the foot bar. Your feet stay lengthened the same, you know, still, so your hips are grounded, and a lot of people do this, and their other arm, you know, kind of points forward towards their feet, but it doesn't have any energy in it because the rope is slack, right? Well, if you really push that arm that way, and then pull the other elbow back, you've got the, say you're rotating to the right, you're pulling the right elbow back and pushing the left arm forward towards your feet, you're actually going to, if you keep the shoulders stable, wring out and rotate that spine more, which is the whole point of the exercise. Hopefully you can see that. And then as you go the other way, even though there's no energy or no tension in the rope, you want to get that push and the pull to really get the ring out. Can you get the exercise without the opposition? Yeah, but the people that really get the benefits and really are dripping at the end, they're getting the opposition, most likely, or they're just really, really out of shape. Okay, so another one is the leg lowers in the series of five, so the double straight leg stretch. All right, make sure I said that right. That series names, the classical names are so confusing. So my feeling of the opposition there is reaching out the feet, get the leg stretch part of it, the name, and then you want to ground your bra hook. So really bow up and feel the bra hook pressing back and feel the opposition, because what happens is as the legs reach out, if you don't have the opposition in the legs reaching, the bra hook pops up and you just end up with this huge lordosis and this big arch in your back, and it hurts your back. Okay, and that's why that exercise can be really dangerous if people don't get it. So there's a lot of ways to cue that. Probably one of my favorites, I think it was Chrissy Ruby I learned this from. She puts like a ribbon or a towel or something under that part in your back, and you can pull on it while the client's doing the exercise, and if they lose tension, they got that tactile feedback of they're losing it. You can just tell them to press the bra hook down, and you can feel that really clearly. As soon as you've – I give that cue to them as the indicator of when their legs have gone far enough. And you'll hear me probably in the iPilates, but if not, some other videos, giving that cue where you lower your legs as far as you can go, keeping the bra hook down. So the bra hook starts to come up, game over, you got to bring the legs back up. Okay? And that's what I'm cueing is the opposition there. Okay, one more example there. In the feet and strap series, the leg lowers. So same name, different exercise. So on the reformer, you got the feet and the straps reaching the sits bones to the heels. So when you're doing the leg lowers, reaching, when you go on the up phase, the feet are reaching up, the heels reach up, and the sits bones reach down. Because what happens? People want to tuck their pelvis. Again, not going to hurt them, but it's going to lose the beautiful yumminess of that stretch. And so I'll tell people, okay, we will get your back stretched later. Don't do it now. So get the sits bones and reach them down, you know, really ground your tip end of your tailbone, whatever cue works. But you just don't want them to tuck. And then you're reaching in opposition out up those heels. Now, you don't want people to flex their feet so much they drop the straps and it hits them in the face. That's not good. So that they're, you know, this is a more advanced cue for somebody that has control of their ankle joints and such. But the ankles can stay open while they reach up through the heels and down into the sits bones. So try those four. You got mermaid, the rowing back series rotation, and then you've got the leg lowers from the feet and straps and leg lowers out of the series of five. And you can find those oppositions. And I would challenge you to do a series workout, whichever lesson plan you want, or make up your own or whatever. Work yourself out and try to find the opposition in every exercise. Okay, that's your challenge for this week. If you are able to do that, and you probably might come up with some that you're like, what? I don't feel it in this one. Where's the opposition? So send me an email and let me know. If you're listening to this years later, you can still send me that email. I am totally fine with this. I think there's an ongoing discussion that should happen because once you understand the opposition, it will help you understand the purpose of the exercise as well as how to help someone be safe and get more out of the exercise at the same time. So you've got like win-win-win right there going on. And it's not something people really talk about. This isn't a very advanced teaching skill, and I think you guys can handle it. So let me know your thoughts and if you have any questions on particular exercises. Have a great night, and I want you to remember to convey to your clients that everybody deserves to enjoy movement. Not just the athletes or the skinny people, but everybody does, and that you can help them enjoy movement. Thanks. Good night.